This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Utah's no longer on the floor. The Thunder are no longer on its bench. The officials have gone back to the locker room. The fans here in the arena don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going on.
ESPN announcers were left in the dark when Wednesday night's Utah Jazz-Oklahoma City Thunder game was called off after Jazz center Rudy Gobert tested positive for the coronavirus. The NBA was the first major North American sport to suspend its season, and the rest of the active leagues followed suit. And that's where we're going to start this week. But first, I'm going to take a second to say, if you've had enough of the coronavirus talk, don't worry. We have some great stories coming up that do not include words like global pandemic and test kits. I'm joined by Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Hello.
Well, thanks for having me back.
Okay, Mike, you're up first.
Well, your show has never been more least aptly named than this week, Only a Game, because there are no games. NCAA tournament canceled. Major League Baseball to delay opening game. NHL suspended. All NBA. Real Madrid and Juventus also postponed. And I was having this weird feeling a day or two ago when I had come to the conclusion that this doesn't make sense and everyone has to socially distance. You could turn on the TV and watch sporting events, and it was just absolutely the wrong message. I understand you don't want to panic, but if you're in New York City and the mayor of New York and the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, is giving you all these pretty well thought out instructions to socially isolate and work from home if you can. And then when you're home and you click on the game and there's 20,000 people at Madison Square Garden, it gives absolutely the wrong message. And in fact, the Golden State Warriors refused the advice of local officials not to play a game in the crowded Chase Arena. They did so. Then they announced on Thursday they would be playing a game in an empty arena. But in the meantime, the NBA suspended all of the games. Took a little while longer for the NHL to follow suit. Broadway shut down. It all needs to come down. And sports needs to lead the way by saying, we're going to take this pause and you can too.
Shireen?
I mean, you try to find light in places that are darkness. And I mean, above the concerns that, you know, you have for general communities and people that are most vulnerable who will be affected, you know, the poor, immunocompromised, and the elderly, we have to wonder how sports plays into this. Because one of the questions that a lot of people were asking was, how is it that Rudy Gobert, who basically poked fun at all this, was so quickly tested? And that's something that most Americans don't have access to. So there's a lot of questions coming up and how this relates to sports. At the end of the day, the organizers and the men in charge are still trying to hold on to their bags of money, waiting for you Olympics to cancel or postpone. But that cash money, it's just too good to let go of.
I, for one, am not incredibly concerned that the Olympics aren't canceled yet. I mean, those games aren't slated to start until the end of July, and we've got warmer weather coming. If everybody does wash their hands and socially distance, there's still a chance that that could be okay. And organizers say they're in touch with the World Health Organization, and I am just going to trust that they're listening to people who are more knowledgeable about how diseases spread than I am. And as you mentioned, that cash money, I mean, they've already spent $6 billion on these games. I'm not surprised that they're not keen on taking a bath on that investment. But I am concerned that they haven't made any sort of public statements about what to do in the meantime, because roughly half of the athletes have already qualified. Okay, they can probably continue to train without exposing themselves to anything. But the other half of those slots are still up for grabs. Mike, have you been thinking about the Olympics and all this?
I've been thinking about the Olympics a little, but like you say, they're a little bit off in the future, and I still have, I guess you could say, hope that they will go off relatively unimpaired. I do think that with the other leagues we're talking about, it's not purely a money grab, because the players, for instance, though they have force majeure clauses in their contracts, so they don't have to get paid, say, an act of war or an epidemic, there are good relationships between the owners. It seems unlikely that the owners will withhold money. The owners themselves, most of their money comes from television contracts, and there might be some various make goods, but you could also see that them and their television partners working together so that no one really loses money. The people who would lose money are the per-game workers at the arenas, mm-hmm. you know, and they're the mm-hmm. last people who would be thought of in these situations. And also, I think there are some interesting wrinkles to this, like we thought that Kevin Durant wouldn't be available to play this year because of his injury. Well, what if the NBA season, you know, gets punted by a few weeks and he could come back in the playoffs? I just think that there can be a couple of interesting things that happen because of this that we haven't thought of that might not all be terrible.
But my only problem with that is that the NBA season is delayed. It'll cut into the WNBA, and I'm very protective of that space, as it is.
All right, I'm going to make just a sort of slight segue here because I'd like to dive a bit deeper into the NCAA's failed attempt to go ahead with March Madness without the fans. Even before the drama, before the Jazz Thunder game on Wednesday night, before Nebraska coach Fred Hoiberg left a game visibly ill, I was really perplexed by this decision. I mean, yes, on the one hand, March Madness, like the Olympics, is huge money. It accounts for more than 75% of the NCAA's yearly revenue. But first of all, this crazy plan hinged on the idea that the NCAA would somehow be able to test all of the players before every game, which is absolutely ridiculous. We have a shortage of testing kits, and I'm pretty sure that we should be using them on sick people. But beyond that, I work on the campus of a university, and I've been watching this school and many, many others cancel classes, cancel university-sponsored travel, cancel spring break service trips, and I keep asking myself if it's not a good idea to have 30 students sitting in the same classroom. Why is it okay to have 30 student athletes swapping sweat on the basketball court? Am I wrong, or was the NCAA's attempt to keep this tournament going just another example of the inherent hypocrisy in the phrase student athlete?
I absolutely agree with you, and it seems like the decision was thrust upon them. And if you look at the timeline, more reporting will come out, but it looks like certain member institutions, including Duke and Kansas, said, well, we're not going to be participating. And then you say, well, what kind of national champion are we going to actually crown? Then I started seeing a bunch of other schools saying, we're suspending all activities indefinitely. And then the NCAA made their decision. So, yes, it did seem like of all these, the NCAA was certainly not in the vanguard of doing things right compared to other cultural institutions. Compared to sports, it was a little bit lagging. Even compared to college basketball itself, the NCAA writ large wasn't a protective umbrella. It was sort of dragged along by its best members.
I completely agree. I don't think we're ever going to look to the NCAA to be sort of a stalwart in principle and integrity.
Yeah.
So, I mean, at this point, we need to look at the protection of the athletes. I'm also going to be quite honest, like, what am I going to watch? Mm. Like, I finished Parks and Rec again. What am I going to watch this year?
All right, Shireen, please take us away from the coronavirus.
Well, Karen, I know you said we weren't going to talk about a global pandemic anymore, but sexism is definitely one of them. So, my friends, U.S. soccer representative Carlos Cuadra came out and apologized. And you're wondering, why did he apologize? He apologized because the language used in a USSF filing against the U.S. women's national team players alleged that women shouldn't get equal pay because the men have, quote unquote, more responsibility. Yes, folks, the team that hasn't made the last World Cup has more responsibility. The team that has never won a world championship has more responsibility. And we're all sitting wondering, well, first of all, we're wondering if we can actually name five players of the men's team as opposed to most of the women in the starting lineup of the U.S. women's team. But the language used in this was atrocious. As I mentioned, Cuadra did apologize, but only after people started to call for his firing. And the best part of all this is this language was released, yes, on International Women's Day, because the timing of this is even more pathetic than you would think. Nonsensical is an understatement. In an interesting turn of events, some of the men's players have come out in support of the women's team, which is not something that I, who have covered this story, the suit, for a while, I mean, have ever seen this type of support from the men's team. So there always is a silver lining in that dark abyss of sexism.
Mike, where are you on this?
Walker Zimmerman. He's a man who plays for the men's team, apparently.
Well done. Yeah, did you have to look that up?
Yes, of course. Brendan Aronson. Oh. Brandon Cerviana. I have no idea. I have been reporting on that suit. And when it comes to suits, obviously the lawyers sometimes make good arguments, sometimes make bad arguments. And in this case, make really bad arguments that don't seem to have a lot of legal weight, but also can hurt the overall strategy at hand. Because the U.S. Soccer Federation has to know that even if they have a better case in the eyes of the law, even if the courts say, look, this really all comes down to this was a collectively bargained agreement. Like, it is true, legal experts that I've talked to and consulted about this says it may be true that it comes down to something as technical as that to talk about technical and skills. But the U.S. Soccer Federation also has to know the big threat isn't that they'll lose a court case. It's that the public will really go against them. So they have to argue in a way that is at least not terribly insulting to their workers, to the heroes of America. And this was incredibly insulting. It was a stupid argument to say that the women don't have skills. You could say they aren't as strong and fast because those are measurable, but that's not what skills are in the game of soccer. Yeah. The U.S. Soccer Federation should defend its legal position as forcefully as they can. But they should also realize if you win and you turn off all the fans and you make your most high profile employees hate you, have you really won?
No. And we should mention that Carlos Cordero resigned late on Thursday over this whole thing, and for good reason. I mean, earlier in the week, he apologized for the language in the brief, saying it did not reflect the values of our federation. Like, really? Did the U.S. Soccer Federation hire a law firm and then not pay attention to what they were doing? I know I'm not an expert in law, but if that's how these things work, maybe we need to look at how these things work.
I mean, I love the apologies. I'm sorry for us being sexist. And the next time we're sexist, we won't use such severely sexist language.
Right.
I mean, that's pretty much what he said. And I've never seen anything like this in sports where someone who is being sued apologizes. You know, it's fascinating on one hand, but it's bizarre.
I mean, I think U.S. soccer knew exactly what was in those filings, and they're only walking it back because, frankly, their sponsors spoke up. Like, Coca-Cola and Visa both came out with statements against the language in the filing. And frankly, those sponsors only spoke up because they know fans won't buy stuff from companies that support organizations that use sexist and misogynistic language.
This is a bad look. This is just is beyond anything I've ever seen of this type of stubbornness in a way. Like, there's not even a meaningful effort to work together because, like Mike said, the language here is really, really bad. And it was intentional, as we know from Carly Lloyd's deposition, because they talked about this and those transcripts are available.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed, who also co-hosts the Burn It All Down podcast, and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
70 years ago this week, 12 members of the Czechoslovak national hockey team were arrested and charged with treason.
Word had come down from higher authorities that they were an anti-state element. And in a communist state in communist Czechoslovakia, this was a high crime.
That story's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Need more good news in your podcast feed? Listen to Kind World, a podcast from WBUR, where we share how an act of kindness can transform lives. New episodes on Tuesdays. Subscribe to Kind World now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Bruce Berglund is a historian and a writer. He works at a small college in Minnesota. But back in the winter of 1998, he was living in Prague.
I was doing research on my dissertation in 20th century Czechoslovak history.
And that February, an event was being held 5,000 miles from Prague in Japan, and Czechs were following it quite closely.
Another full house here in Big Hat. The fans here.
This was the Nagano Winter Olympics. And this was the first Winter Olympics that included NHL players. So there was a lot of buildup, a lot of excitement. And with that tournament, it was expected, in fact, going into the tournament, that Canada would come away with the gold medal. Canada was led by Wayne Gretzky. They had a roster that was stocked with players who are now in the Hall of Fame. The Russians were touted as one of the favorites. The Americans were touted as favorites. And the Czechs ended up surprising everyone.
Hašek makes a save. The Czech Republic win it 2-1.
They defeated Canada in a shootout in the semifinal.
In the final, the Czech Republic faced off against Russia.
Because the Olympics were in Japan, we had to get up early, early in the morning to watch the gold medal match.
S nožem, zakázané uvolnění.
A lot of Czechs tuned into that game, right?
Yeah, it's estimated that 80% of Czech adults at some point during the game were tuned in.
Svoboda! Goal! Je to tam! Je to tam!
So I was in a small Czech town the day of the final match, and when the final horn sounded, when the Czechs had won, when they received their gold medals, everybody in this small town poured into the town square, cheering, singing, waving flags. The fire truck came down and drove around and blared its sirens. A lot of alcohol was consumed for very early on a Sunday morning. And yeah, it was just this wonderful, enthusiastic celebration of the Czech hockey team.
The team returned home, flying into the airport on the outskirts of Prague.
Crowds, huge crowds at the airport there to greet them. They stopped first at the president's house, and they were out on the front lawn having shots of Slivovica. They boarded the bus and went down into the center where at least 100,000 people were packed into the old town square in the center of Prague.
So this moment was a big deal for Czechs for a bunch of reasons. For one, the Czechs had won world championships before and after splitting from Slovakia, but they'd never won Olympic gold. But as Bruce was talking to people in Prague, he realized there was another reason Czechs were especially excited about this win. It was a story that had been on people's minds for a long time.
This story of the 1950 hockey team, of the injustice that they experienced, this is a widely known story among Czechs.
Bruce went back to Prague last fall. He visited the National Archives and the archives of the former state security services, known in Czech as the STB. And after viewing thousands of documents, he finally was able to piece together the story. But to really understand what happened to the 1950 Czech hockey team, we have to go back to the end of World War II.
People in Czechoslovakia were hungry for hockey after the war.
That's the voice of Prague actor František Spáček. He's reading translated passages from the memoir of Stanislav Konopasek. Konopasek was one of the players on that 1950 Czechoslovak national team. He died in 2008.
We were happy when we could start playing international matches again. We had good results on our first trips to Switzerland, Sweden, and England.
So the team was doing well.
Yes. So in 1947, Prague hosts the first hockey world championships to be hosted after World War II.
Canada didn't send a team to those world championships. And without the best team in the world in attendance, Czechoslovakia won. And this was a big deal. See, Czechoslovakia had a unique political position. It saw itself as a bridge between the communist Soviet Union and the democratic West. And so any international success the country had was really celebrated as proof that Czechoslovakia could thrive in this middle ground. But while things were going great on the ice, political tensions were heating up.
Prague is again the battleground of ideologies.
Czechoslovakia had a coalition government. The president was a non-communist, Edvard Beneš. The prime minister was the leader of the Communist Party, Klement Gottwald. In 1948, communist parties in Europe, they get the signal from Moscow that it is time to take full control of their governments.
Today in the capital, communist premier Gottwald carries an ultimatum to President Beneš.
President Benesch recognizes that the situation is inevitable. A few months later, Benesch resigns and Gottwald becomes the president of the country.
History repeats itself. Where will the stand for freedom be made?
Through all of this, and a plane crash that killed six members of the team in 1948, the Czechoslovak national team continued to compete, and they continued to win, even beating out the Canadians for the 1949 World Championship.
So the following year, the 1950 World Championships are going to be staged in London. And the Czechoslovak national team is preparing to leave. They go to the airport outside of Prague, and they don't board the plane.
We waited a long time at the airport for our flight. We thought there must be some malfunction. After a time, they told us that the flight was postponed until the next day. In the morning, we went back to the airport and waited again. Nobody believed anymore that there was a problem with the plane. After about 2 hours, the team manager and some security service officers came to announce that we were not flying to London.
The security officers say, well, two journalists accompanying the team have been denied their visas by the British.
You don't want the people of Czechoslovakia to listen to the World Championship over some foreign radio services, do you?
In other words, the players were told that in solidarity with the journalists and for the good of their country, they would be giving up the opportunity to win another championship for the good of their country. It didn't make a lot of sense.
The players headed off to a pub. It was late in the evening. They were wanting to eat dinner. And when they went to the pub, they began to talk over beer of how angry they were, how upset they were with the government's handling of the team. And while they're at dinner, it comes over the radio, a news announcement that the Czechoslovak hockey team had joined in solidarity with Czechoslovak journalists who had been denied visas by the British government. And this set the players off. They start swearing. They start cussing. They cussed out Gottwald. They cussed out the communists. And, of course, there were other people in the restaurant listening, and these people report to the police what's happening. So at about 9 o'clock p.m., the police show up, the STB, and the players are brought to the police station and they undergo interrogation, including torture. The players were surprised to learn that they were being charged with treason. This was a huge shock.
It was a huge shock. None of us had been interested in politics before. Never.
The police were particularly interested in a man named Bohumil Modrý. Modrý had been the team's goalie. During the summer and fall of 1949, Modrý became more and more disenchanted with the way the team was organized and particularly the way the communist sports authorities dealt with the national team. And so Modrý had left the team before this planned trip to London in 1950. The questions kept revolving around Modrý and Modrý's contacts with foreigners, particularly with Americans who worked at the U.S. Embassy in Prague. And it was the case that Modrý did have contacts with an American at the U.S. Embassy. Modrý did introduce this American to other members of the team. So the charges were not fabricated. There were indeed connections between the hockey players and Westerners. Talk of defecting, talk of emigrating, had been circulating among the hockey players ever since the communists took power in 1948.
The trial was very simple.
The trial is really perfunctory. Their guilt had already been determined. They have the sense that word had come down from up above, from higher authorities, that they were an anti-state element. And in a communist state in communist Czechoslovakia, this was a high crime.
Did the players think they were guilty of that?
No, but because the communists were still new in terms of having power in Czechoslovakia, they had to demonstrate that nobody, including the world champion hockey players, was excused from socialist justice.
12 players were put on trial. 12 players were convicted. Their sentences ranged from 15 years for Modri, the goalie, to 8 months for a player deemed to be less involved in the plot. And this wasn't going to be easy time at a country club jail.
No, the players were sent to work in the uranium mines in the western part of Czechoslovakia, close to the German border. And really, this is notorious as one of the worst places of communist oppression, a work camp extracting uranium, which was used for the Soviet military in conditions without any safeguards whatsoever.
We wore no masks. We breathed uranium dust fully into lungs. Uranium was on our clothes all the time. We didn't even have a shower. After work, we just washed up before going to the bed.
So these were terrible conditions, and the state police really had no regard for the health of the prisoners, whether hockey players or any other kind of prisoner. The players were released in 1955, so this comes after the death of Stalin in 1953, and shortly after that, the death of Klement Gottwald, the president of Czechoslovakia. Many of the players are allowed to return to hockey. They play in the highest league in Czechoslovakia, but none of them are allowed to play for the national team again.
So in this memoir that we've been hearing pieces from, we hear a theory about why the players were put through all of this.
In my opinion, the whole event was managed from Moscow.
Stanislav Konopasek, he makes the case that this was something that was ordered from Moscow. And the reason was is that it was at this time in the late 1940s, in the early 1950s, that the Soviet Union was developing their own hockey program. So by getting the world champion Czechoslovak hockey team out of the way, this would open up the path for the rise of the Soviet hockey team.
And not to state the obvious, but that kind of worked, right?
It did work. Exactly.
So knowing this whole story, how does that shape how you see what you saw in 98 with the great celebration over the Olympic win? Because it feels like more than just a win in a sporting event.
Yes, during the winter of 1997-1998, this was really a difficult time in the Czech Republic in terms of politics, in terms of the economy. The economy was slowing down. So this was roughly a decade after the Velvet Revolution, the end of communism. There were a lot of questions at this time as to what had the transition to democracy and capitalism brought. One of the newspaper headlines after the Olympic win in 1998 called this the victorious February. When the communists took power in February of 1948, they called their bloodless coup Victorious February. And so the headlines 50 years later in February 1998 were intended to suggest that our difficult history of living under communism and then the difficult transition from communism, in some ways this has been mitigated, that we have a new Victorious February.
Bruce Berglund has a new book coming out in December. It's called The Fastest Game in the World, Hockey and the Globalization of Sports. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Yes, I know all the sports are canceled. So how are you going to get your sports fix? Consider subscribing to the Only a Game podcast. Until the actual games return, we'll be happy to keep you entertained with great stories set in sports. In 2017, an artist named Anika Orok showed up at the annual reunion for the former players of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
And I just thought, someone's going to bust me for this? Someone's going to be like, wait a minute, did you just find us on the internet? How did you know?
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
This week on NPR's Invisibilia, we take you to a summer program for teenagers with sleepovers, marshmallows, and racial confrontation.
I want you to all line up by skin tone, lightest to darkest.
That's up next on NPR's Invisibilia.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, we'll have the story of a years-long family feud that played out through basketball-themed poetry. All you need to know is that Duke does, in fact, rhyme with puke. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Yes, hi, Karen. That's going to sustain me through these days of isolation and no sports.
Well, pretty much all of the sports are suspended in response to the coronavirus pandemic. Any idea what you're going to do with your time?
I have absolutely no idea, except I know there's a lot of old sports to watch on YouTube. I'm thinking about doing the entire run of ABC's Wide World of Sports because I've been missing, you know, barrel jumping from Grossinger's.
Well, sometimes athletes lead the way. This week, Utah Jazz center Rudy Gobert led the way in showing the world how not to respond to a global health crisis, right?
Yes, and he has since apologized, and I think we should let Rudy off the hook just a little bit. At the time he did what he did, which was essentially to grab a bunch of microphones and recording devices at a press conference and touch them all and pretend he was giving everyone the virus. I mean, it was sort of like within bounds of acceptable humor, but it's not anymore.
And we should remind people that although he didn't know it at the time, Rudy Gobert has since tested positive for the coronavirus.
Yeah, and so has another member of the Jazz, Donovan Mitchell.
The cancellation of games is disappointing for fans at home, but it's potentially devastating for people who staff our sporting arenas. Cleveland Cavaliers star Kevin Love and Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban have both pledged to financially support arena workers. I hope we see more of this, don't you?
Yeah, I do, because if we don't see more of this, we're going to see a hell of a lot more of lawsuits, because you know a lot of people depend on their job selling popcorn and souvenirs. The NBA is certainly wealthy enough to carry these folks for a while.
UConn women's basketball coach Gino Auriemma would like to see the NCAA grant another year of eligibility to seniors after March Madness and other spring tournaments were canceled. Most notably, Oregon's Sabrina Ionescu decided not to go to the WNBA last spring so that she would have a chance to lead her school to a national championship this year. So should she be given the opportunity to try again in 2021 if that's what she wants to do?
Yeah, I don't see a lot of, you know, certainly not the top line players on the men's side doing that because the NBA draft is right around the corner. But I don't think there's any problem with giving folks the option. You know, I guess it would complicate recruiting a little bit, but who cares? Yeah, I don't have a problem with giving players that option. I don't.
Barry Bonds says he feels like he's been given the death sentence by baseball and Hall of Fame voters in particular. Not a great choice of words, given everything that's going on right now. But Bonds says his heart is broken. He feels like a ghost over the way the sport has banished him over the years. Do you feel at all bad for Barry Bonds?
To an extent, I do. I mean, but a very small extent and a very limited extent. And given the events of the past week, it's really hard to care about anything else except the people who are in peril of this virus. But yeah, I do think first of all, he belongs in the Hall of Fame. I'm tired of the moralistic streak on the part of the Hall of Fame electorate. I mean, just put him in. What possible long-term consequences could there be?
Charlie, the suspension of play in the NHL means 53-year-old baseball Hall of Famer Larry Walker will not get his chance to act as the Colorado Avalanche's honorary emergency goalie. The Avs were planning on having a regular emergency goalie on hand in case of an actual goalie emergency, so I have no idea what exactly an honorary emergency goalie would have done. Do you?
Well, I think you probably come out and skate a little bit before each period. And, you know, I don't think you pull on the pads, but maybe you do. I mean, if you know you're not going in the game. Walker, we should note, by the way, is from Maple Ridge, British Columbia.
Oh.
So this just isn't an honorary thing. I mean, he grew up dreaming about being an NHL goalie.
And finally, Charlie, Ezzeldine Bahader scored a goal for an Egyptian third-tier soccer club last Saturday. And why do we care about a goal scored in an Egyptian third-tier match?
because Ezeldin is 75 years old, and he played all 90 minutes with an injury and scored his goal. So he is now the oldest footy player to score a goal in an official game, as official as this particular league happens to be. He is a father of four and a grandfather of six, so good for Ezeldin. Somebody out there is playing sports, Karen.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
Anika Orok's new book starts like this.
This book is dedicated to the women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and to all women and girls everywhere throughout time who perpetuate the gift of possibility by having the grit and tenacity to stay true to themselves.
Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story of that book and how it came to be.
Anika Orok can't remember a time when she didn't draw.
I always had these stories in my head. It was like I couldn't ever write fast enough to get down what I saw in my head. Everything was always visual, so I would always draw out the story before I would write it.
Anika's very first drawing was of her grandfather.
He was sort of self-described as an egg on two toothpicks. Easy for a kid to draw, I guess.
So tell me, like, who was your grandfather?
Who was Ray Orok? You know, I don't even know if you could ever nail that down, but he started out as a cartoonist.
Ray Orok earned money in high school and college selling his cartoons to publications like the Napa Sunday Journal and the Catholic Voice. He kept drawing, hand illustrating birthday cards for the family, even after becoming a full-time writer. For 35 years, he wrote a daily column that appeared in East Bay syndicated newspapers. Anika was an only child, and she always had a special connection with her grandfather. He and the rest of the family called her Nick.
You know, my aunt was just talking to me the other day about this, where she said from the get-go, there was such a different bond between my grandfather and I that she said, honest to God, if you weren't born at different times, I would think you were the same person.
They loved Cheers and the Mary Tyler Moore Show, but most importantly for this story, they loved baseball.
As far as baseball goes, I think I loved it before I even understood it.
Growing up, Anika spent weekends, or sometimes whole summers, with her grandparents. They'd watch the San Francisco Giants on TV or listen on the radio.
It just was always on, and I just loved the sound of it.
During her first semester at San Jose State University, Anika learned her grandfather had cancer. Less than a year later, in March 2008, Ray Orok died. Anika says before that, she hadn't had the guts to sign up for an illustration class at San Jose State. But after her grandfather's death, she felt a new sense of clarity about what mattered and what didn't. She knew drawing brought her joy, so she signed up for a class. Anika went on to work in the animation industry, and she started a side project drawing scenes from MLB games. In her third season, Anika wanted to put together a collection of her baseball art for a convention.
So I had, I don't even know how many, a few hundred at least, of these drawings. And I was going through them, and I think it was like about two-thirds of the way through the pile before this weird thing dawned on me where I just thought there were so many different things going on at these games. Every game was different. Every game ended up different. There were different plays, but oddly, a lot of these look the same. And why do they look the same?
Anika realized that was because the majority of her illustrations were of men.
And then it kind of dawned on me how odd that was as a woman. And that opened up a whole different awareness of, like, gosh, all of my mentors, my idols, my favorite cartoonists, you know, not all, but most have been men. Just kind of this weird, like, huh.
So what did you start to do next?
Well, I just got kind of like, screw this. Just a little bit defiant. Like, okay, I'm a woman. I love baseball this much, there has to be great stories of women in baseball. So the first thing that came to mind was the movie A League of Their Own.
Show us something different. Put it by you.
Anika started doing more research on the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League and the women who played from Racine to Rockford to South Bend to Fort Wayne from 1943 to 1954.
It was exhilarating. It was like, oh, wow, new things to draw, new things to explore, new stories. And the more I read and the more fascinating they were, the more I found myself starting to identify with them. Not necessarily because they were anything I had experienced firsthand, but just the sheer fact that these stories are coming from women, and I'm a woman, and they were doing things with the men and the boys in arenas where mostly men were. They, from the time they were kids, kind of just like me.
Anika was hooked. She put together a proposal for a book that would feature stories and illustrations of former players, and she sent the proposal off to a publisher. Soon, Anika was having coffee with an editor.
They wanted it to be more of a history, more comprehensive, more stories. And I thought, great, this will be awesome. And I even asked her, I said, well, so who's going to write it? She said, well, you are.
Anika hadn't planned on that.
And almost fell into a panic attack. Like, how do you even know I can write a book? I mean, I've never written a book.
Pulling this off was going to take a lot of research. Anika learned there was an annual reunion for the league's former players. She used the money from her book advance to travel to Cincinnati.
And I just thought, someone's going to bust me for this? Someone's going to be like, wait a minute, did you just find us on the internet? How did you know? I had no idea what I was doing. So just to be safe, I printed a bunch of prints of the art that I had done inspired by the league and packaged them up nice, just kind of as like a peace offering, I guess. I've always been one of those people that like brought banana bread to an like an awkward social gathering just to sort of break the, I don't know, but that was what I did.
Anika didn't know anybody when she showed up at the hotel in downtown Cincinnati.
Nobody gave me a weird side eye or anything, but it just was, it wasn't like showing up to a convention or anything. I was showing up to a very intimate, familiar gathering.
It was like just crashing someone's family reunion or something like that.
Totally. Exactly. I was definitely the fake cousin.
But finally, one of the real family members started talking to Anika, and Anika says she was able to warm up. She started collecting interviews with former players. And after the reunion, Anika continued reaching out by phone.
A few of the women I called, and I would introduce myself, say what I was doing, and, all right, yeah, I'll tell you about it. What do you want to know? You know, there were a few of them that just were like, let's get this over with. And it was so hard, because I so badly just wanted to be like, you know what, if you don't feel like talking, it's okay. You know, don't worry about it, you know? But I really had to just do my best to get them to just talk a little bit. And there was this thing that would happen with all of them, every single one of them, almost, with the exception of one who hung up on me. But I think it's just because she couldn't hear me. But I know, it's kind of sad. But all of them would get to this point and they would start telling a story. And I could just almost feel everything start gaining momentum and the pistons going on the other end of the phone. And inevitably, they would get going to the point where they would just go forever.
When Anika went back for the reunion the next year, she knew she was still the new guy. She tried to stay on the periphery.
But they have this thing every year. I just think it's so great that they have this reunion every year of these trailblazers. And they get together, and in the middle of it all is a lip sync contest. I won't go into the story of how it happened, but I kind of got roped into doing it. Sort of, well, not even sort of, very reluctantly.
Anika didn't have much time to prepare, but she had a vague memory of her aunt doing a pantomime performance at one of her grandfather's birthday parties.
And the only thing I could really remember was the song. Debbie Boone's You Light Up My Life.
So many nights I'd sit by.
I didn't even think of how appropriate it might be, like as sort of a gratitude song. I really just went with it because I remembered it and I didn't have time to do anything else.
Anika brought some props, a flashlight and a box of life cereal, for some cheesy but intricate choreography.
And I had, at the last minute, grabbed like a battery-operated pack of LED lights and wrapped them around an old Life magazine cover that had a woman from the All-American Girls Baseball League the cover. And I held it up and it lit up. And the room just like exploded. And I looked down and there's all these women like standing up out of their seats. One woman's like holding up her cane. She has a baseball bat cane. It's amazing.
Anika Orok won the contest.
I my first feeling was guilt, like, oh God, I shouldn't be winning this.
But soon she was ushered to the hotel bar.
And I, honest to God, witnessed these 80-year-old women, some of them taking shots of Crown Royal. It was a party till 2:30 in the morning. But what happened was then, for the rest of the reunion, people were coming up to me. You know, these women are dragging their family. This is the girl I was telling you about that did that lip sync. Oh my God, I heard all about that. And I don't know. People who were not quite warming up to me before that were coming up to me and talking to me about it. It was the weirdest thing. It had nothing to do with my art. It had nothing to do with baseball. It had nothing to do with the insane amounts of research I'd been doing on these women that made the inside of my art studio look like the set of Homeland with like yarn string. I mean, it was like absurd. It had nothing to do with any of that. It was just this performance of You Light Up My Life that just like, I don't know, just made me feel like, okay, you can hang around.
Anika was able to finish all the research she needed for her book. What was it like when you finally got your hands on a copy of the book?
Oh my God. Unreal. I didn't know that I could be a researcher or a historian or an archivist, or I didn't know I could illustrate 160 pages. I didn't know I could write a book. These are not things that I really ever envisioned myself being capable of. And I did it.
What do you think your grandfather's reaction would be to this book?
Sorry. I haven't really taken a second even consider that. I wish you could hear his voice like I can hear it in my head. Because he'd probably say something like, ah, geez, Nick. This is just fantastic. I can hear him saying that. But he said that about everything. I decorated their Christmas tree every year, and it was always the best tree ever. It was better than last year. Every year was better than last year. I'm like, it's the same tree. But I would just hope that he would enjoy reading it. And I think he would.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Anika Orok's The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League went on sale on Tuesday. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.